So 63% of therapists in private practice are right now technically operating with a massive silent liability. Like they just aren't writing treatment plans at all. And if an auditor or, you know, the licensing board knocks on their door tomorrow, they could literally lose everything they've built.
Yeah, it is a staggering statistic. I mean, you have these highly trained, really brilliant clinicians who are essentially driving blindfolded, legally speaking.
Right.
They just kind of assume that because they do good work in the room, you know, the paperwork doesn't really matter. But the exact moment someone requests a chart, that whole illusion just shatters.
Completely shatters. Welcome to this personalized deep dive, by the way. We designed this roadmap exclusively for you, the learner.
Yeah, we know you are a beginner therapist looking to start a solo private practice right here in British Columbia.
Exactly. And we also know you don't need another lecture on, like, active listening or theoretical frameworks. You already have that. You need to know how to actually survive the business side of this profession.
Right. So we are pulling from a massive stack of sources for you today. We've got interviews with fractional CFOs, healthcare lawyers, and some really highly successful Canadian practice owners.
They're real experts.
Exactly. And the goal is to distill the absolute most critical first steps, highlight those hidden traps that just bankrupt new practitioners, and show you how to build a practice that actually serves both your clients and your own life.
Okay, let's unpack this. Starting a practice means making a massive identity shift.
Oh, huge.
You're transitioning from being just a caregiver to becoming an actual business owner.
Mm-hmm.
But the timeline on that shift is where people seem to get really confused. Like, I think a lot of people assume you become a business owner when you sign a commercial lease, or maybe...
or when you hire a web designer or something.
Yeah, exactly. But the legal and financial sources are incredibly blunt about this. They say you become a business owner the exact second someone hands you a check for therapy.
Yeah, that threshold is completely non-negotiable. Whether you're seeing one client on a Saturday morning in a little shared sublease, or you have 30 clients a week in your own fancy suite, the moment money exchanges hands for clinical services, you are operating a business in the eyes of the Canada Revenue Agency.
Wow.
But new therapists usually swing to one of two extremes here. They either like teeter in or they just go way overboard.
So let's break down those extremes. What does teetering actually look like in practice?
Well, teetering means they sort of treat the practice like a side hobby. You know, they use their personal Gmail account, they don't set up formal accounting, and they just kind of cross their fingers and hope the admin takes care of itself.
Right. And the other extreme.
On the flip side, some therapists get so anxious about, quote unquote, doing it right, that they immediately jumped into setting up an expensive, super complex professional corporation.
Oh, geez.
Right. They spend thousands of dollars on legal fees, corporate tax filings, and heavy accounting overhead before they even have, like, a steady stream of clients.
Which is wild, because the consensus from the legal sources is that neither extreme makes any sense for a beginner in BC.
Not at all.
Like, starting as a sole proprietorship, operating simply under your full legal name is completely fine. It costs nothing to set up, and it gives you the flexibility to build your revenue without suffocating under all those corporate maintenance fees.
Exactly. But, and this is a massive, but if you take the sole proprietor route, the sources absolutely scream about one foundational rule. Do not commingle your funds.
Commingling funds.
Yeah.
It's like a chef trying to cook a 5-star meal in the kitchen where the clean ingredients are just mixed in with the garbage.
That is a perfect analogy.
Like, it makes the actual work impossible to do cleanly.
Right. It's the deadliest sin of new business owners. Yeah. If you are buying your personal groceries, you know, from the same checking account where your clients are paying their session fees, you are setting a ticking time bomb.
Okay, I understand it makes bookkeeping a little messy, but why is it a deadly sin? Like, can't I just go through my bank statement at the end of the year and highlight the business expenses in yellow and the personal ones in pink?
I mean, you could try, but the Canada Revenue Agency won't care about your highlighters if you get audited.
Good point.
When you commingle funds, you blur the line between what is a legitimate business deduction and what is just a personal lifestyle choice. So if an auditor cannot clearly distinguish the boundaries of your practice, they can simply disallow your business expenses entirely.
Oh, wow. So you just lose all those write-offs.
You could be hit with massive back taxes and penalties. And furthermore, if you ever transition to a professional corporation later, you know, to protect your personal assets from liability commingling funds, can lead to a legal concept called piercing the corporate veil.
Which means what exactly?
It means if you get sued, a lawyer can look at your messy accounts, argue that your business is really just a personal slush fund, and suddenly your house and your personal savings are on the line.
Okay, terrifying. So the day one actionable step here is mechanical and immediate. You go to a Canadian institution. The sources mention places like Scotia or EQ Bank, which have low or zero cost business options, and open a separate business checking account, period.
Right, today.
Then get a dedicated business credit card. All revenue goes into that checking account. All business expenses go on that credit card. Nothing personal touches either one.
Yeah, it just creates a clean, totally undeniable paper trail.
I want to push back a bit on this whole business owner title, though, because as I was reading through these interviews with seasoned therapists, there is this visceral resistance to it. Therapists hate the word business. Why do helpers fight this label so hard?
What's fascinating here is that the resistance is totally rooted in their primary training.
How so?
While therapists are heavily conditioned to prioritize empathy, altruism, and alleviating suffering. So the idea of exchanging that deeply intimate healing work for financial gain, Mitchier, it feels like a contradiction of their core values.
They feel guilty.
Exactly. They feel guilty. They feel like acknowledging the profit motive somehow taints the clinical relationship.
But the sources argue that resisting the business label actually degrades client care.
Ooh.
Which is an interesting flip. Like, how does ignoring your bookkeeping make you a worse therapist?
Because the math always catches up to you. I mean, if you don't run a profitable, strictly organized business, you inevitably become stressed, overworked, and financially terrified.
You burn out.
Yeah, you start resenting the work itself. And a terrified, exhausted therapist cannot be fully present, grounded, and empathetic in the room with a client. Putting on your own financial oxygen mask is not greedy. It is a fundamental clinical imperative.
That is such a crucial mindset shift.
Yeah.
But even if you hit that perfect profit margin, you know, and the business is running smoothly, it means absolutely nothing if you catch the flu and have to cancel 2 weeks of sessions.
Oh, definitely.
Because that sustainable math we just talked about shatters instantly. Since as a solo practitioner in BC, you essentially have zero safety net.
Right. And this is where a lot of private practice owners face this sort of existential panic. The sources note this usually hits right around their mid-30s.
Yeah, the interviews paint a very vivid picture of this stress. One therapist talked about hitting 35 and realizing she had literally zero retirement savings.
That's so common.
She spent her 20s paying for an incredibly expensive master's degree, and then she took these low-paying contract jobs, like driving out to remote schools in northern BC for the government just to get her clinical hours. And those didn't offer any pension or benefits.
It's the classic trajectory of the helping professions, right?
Yeah.
You invest heavily in the education, you hustle in agency roles to build your resume, and by the time you finally launch your solo practice, you are fundamentally behind financially.
Yeah.
You don't have paid sick leave, you don't have employer RSP matching, and you definitely don't have a vacation policy.
But the sources do outline a very specific strategy to build that missing safety net. You must automatically divert 5 to 10% of your gross income into a dedicated, untouchable fund.
Called a rainy day fund or a leave fund, whatever you want.
Exactly. And the mechanism here is automation. You set it up so the bank transfers the money before you even have a chance to look at it.
Right. That internal buffer covers short-term shocks, like a bad bout of COVID or just a slow month in the summer. But there is also a systemic Canadian safety net that many solo practitioners completely ignore simply because they assume entrepreneurs are locked out of it.
Here's where it gets really interesting. When I was digging into the federal guidelines mentioned in the notes, I was genuinely surprised by this. Self-employed individuals in Canada, which includes our solo therapist in BC, can actually opt into the Federal Employment Insurance Special Benefits Program.
They absolutely can. And for anyone planning a family or worrying about a long-term illness, this is completely life-changing.
It really is.
As a self-employed clinician, you can access up to 15 weeks of sickness benefits or 12 to 18 months of maternity and parental leave.
That's huge. And how is that calculated?
It's calculated based on your net self-employment income from your previous year's tax return up to a maximum threshold set by the government.
That totally dismantles the narrative that solo entrepreneurs have to sacrifice having a family, or that a severe illness means immediate bankruptcy. The system exists. But there is a massive trap here, isn't there? You can't just discover you're pregnant or get a scary medical diagnosis and sign up the next morning.
No, and that is where people get so heartbroken. The government mechanism requires you to register for the EI Special Benefits Program through Service Canada and pay premiums for one full continuous year before you are allowed to claim a single dime in benefits.
Why the 1 year wait?
To prevent adverse selection. I mean, the government cannot sustain a system where people only pay into the insurance pool when they already know they're about to draw from it. They need you contributing to the fund before the life event happens.
Okay, so the actionable takeaway here is foresight. Opting into programs like EI and actively funding that 10% rainy day account, that is the actual infrastructure that separates a vulnerable hobby from a resilient career.
Well said.
So what does this all mean for the day-to-day operation of the clinic? Let's talk about the leaky bucket. You've got the separate bank accounts, you've opted into EI, you are officially a business owner. Now you have to fill the accounts without burning out.
Yes.
The sources warn heavily about a trap called being booked but broke.
The booked but broke trap is basically an optical illusion. It operates on this flawed assumption that having a full calendar automatically equates to financial stability.
Right. You picture this highly successful therapist. They're seeing 25 or 30 clients a week. They literally do not have a single open slot on their calendar.
Yeah.
But when they run their numbers, they're barely scraping by.
Exactly. The bucket is full of water, but the water is pouring out the bottom just as fast.
Because the business has invisible leaks.
Yeah, and the primary leak is unpaid administrative time. If you see 30 clients, you are likely spending another 10 to 15 hours a week writing progress notes, prepping for sessions, following up with collateral contacts, and answering emails.
So you're working 45 hours, but only billing for 30.
Exactly. Another massive leak is unenforced cancellation policies. Like, a client cancels 3 hours before a session, the therapist feels bad charging them, and suddenly that hour of the day is just a total financial loss.
And the sources also point out a structural leak, which is giving away too many sliding scale slots during prime hours. Like, if you offer a significantly reduced rate to a client, but you give them your 6.0 p.m. Tuesday slot,
which is the most highly demanded hour for full-fee professionals.
Right. You are capping your revenue potential at the exact moment demand is highest.
To plug these leaks, you have to completely change how you calculate your value. The sources really emphasize reverse engineering your fee. And the key variable here is basing your math on your sustainable capacity, not your maximum capacity.
Now, I want to push back here.
Okay, let's hear it.
If my client is a single mother struggling to pay her rent, and I raise my fee by $20 an hour just so I can hit some arbitrary sustainable capacity spreadsheet goal, how is that not a massive betrayal of why I became a therapist in the first place?
Yeah.
That feels incredibly predatory.
I get that. It feels that way because you are looking at the micro interaction instead of the macro reality.
What do you mean?
Let's follow that scenario out. You keep your fee unsustainably low for that single mother and for 25 other clients. 6 months from now, you literally cannot pay your own commercial lease. You can't pay your liability insurance.
Right.
So you burn out, you close your practice entirely, and you go take a corporate job. Now, that single mother has no therapist at all. Sustainable pricing isn't about hoarding wealth. It's about ensuring the clinic exists tomorrow.
Ah, I see.
If you really want to help low-income clients, the most effective way is to build a highly profitable core business, which then securely subsidizes two or three dedicated off-peed sliding scale spots.
That makes a lot of sense, actually. You can't pour from an empty cup, and you certainly can't offer a sliding scale from a bankrupt clinic. So how do we actually do this math?
You start at the end and work backward. First, calculate your required monthly take-home, basically what you need to live a grounded, healthy life. Then add your operating expenses, rent, software insurance. Add your estimated tax burden, which is usually around 30%.
Right. Don't forget the taxes.
Exactly. That gives you your gross monthly revenue target. Then you just divide that total by the number of sessions you can sustainably hold each month, factoring in vacations and sick days.
The impact of doing this math is wild.
Yeah.
The sources provided a breakdown that honestly blew my mind. Let's say your sustainable capacity is 20 clients a week and you work 50 weeks a year. That is 1,000 sessions a year.
Right.
If you run your reverse engineered math and realize you're coming up short, and you increase your average fee by just $10.
That $10 translates to $10,000 of pure profit at the end of the year.
Exactly. Because your base expenses, the rent, the Jane app subscription, the internet, they're already covered by the base fee. Every single dollar of that $10 increase goes straight to the bottom line.
Which brings us to the mechanism for tracking all of this, the profit and loss report, or P&L.
Wait, if I'm a sole proprietor operating under my own name, why do I need a formal corporate profit and loss statement? Can't I just log into my EQ Bank app and see if the balance is going up or down?
Well, checking your bank balance tells you what you have in this exact second, but it tells you nothing about the health or trajectory of your business. A bank balance doesn't warn you that your software subscriptions have crept up by 15% this quarter, or that you haven't set aside nearly enough for your upcoming tax installment.
Oh, that makes sense.
A monthly P&L categorizes your money. It forces you to look at revenue at the top, your line item expenses in the middle, and your true net profit at the bottom.
It's the profit-first mentality. You're actively giving every single dollar a job before it ever leaves the account. Like, this portion is taxes, this portion is rent, this portion is my salary.
Doing this every 30 days moves you from guessing to knowing. It completely removes the emotional weight and dread of tax season because there are zero surprises.
Okay, so we've built the practice, we've optimized the income with sustainable math, and woven a robust safety net. You are feeling secure. But there is one final piece of the puzzle. You need armor to protect everything you've built. And this circles us all the way back to the terrifying statistic we opened with: bulletproof documentation and insurance.
Yeah, clinical paperwork is where therapists carry the most silent anxiety. It's just this constant nagging thought of, I really hope nobody ever asks to look at my charts.
And as we said, only 37% of therapists actually write treatment plans for their clients. Over 60% are just winging it, legally speaking. So what is the actual mechanism of danger here? Who is coming for these notes?
There are two primary threats here. The first is insurance companies. If you are directly billing extended health benefits, or even if a client submits your receipts for reimbursement, the insurance company has the absolute right to audit your files.
And if the files are bad?
If your documentation is poor or missing, they can initiate a clawback. They will legally demand that you pay back thousands of dollars in previously paid session fees because you failed to prove the medical necessity of the treatment.
Ouch. And the second threat?
The regulatory body. In BC, if a client files a grievance against you with your regulatory college threatening your registered clinical counselor, or RCC, license, the very first action the board's investigative committee will take is subpoenaing your clinical notes and treatment plans.
And if you don't have them?
If you don't have a structured map of care, you appear incompetent. You could face severe disciplinary action or even lose your license entirely.
This is why having comprehensive professional liability insurance is your first layer of armor. But therapists frequently make a critical mechanical error here. Your liability insurance must explicitly cover your specific legal entity.
Yes, very important.
Meaning, if I start as a sole proprietor, my insurance covers me personally. But if 2 years from now I transition into a professional corporation, I have to update my policy.
Immediately. If you are operating as, say, John Doe Psychological Services, Inc., and a client sues you, their lawyer is going to cast the widest possible net. They will sue you as an individual clinician, and they will sue the corporate entity.
Wow.
If your insurance only lists your personal name and not the PC, the corporate entity is entirely unprotected.
But insurance only covers the legal defense.
Right.
It doesn't fix the missing paperwork. Let's talk about how to actually write these treatment plans. The sources insist that you can dash out a compliant treatment plan in under 10 minutes if you use a specific mental framework.
This raises an important question, though. What actually constitutes a good treatment plan? The framework requires you to stop trying to write these poetic, philosophical narratives and focus exclusively on medically necessary goals.
Okay.
Licensing boards and insurance auditors do not care if you created a safe space or built rapport. They just assume a safe space is the baseline requirement of simply being a therapist.
So vague goals like achieve higher self-esteem or explore childhood trauma are completely useless to an auditor.
They are worse than useless. They are liabilities because they cannot be measured. The three-step mental framework for a 10-minute treatment plan is this. First, identify a specific symptom tied to a diagnosis. Second, define a measurable reduction in frequency or intensity. Third, connect it to a clinical modality.
Let's run a quick example of that.
Okay, instead of writing, client wants to feel less anxious, you write, client will report a reduction in panic attacks from 4 times a week to 1 time a week, utilizing cognitive behavioral therapy and somatic grounding techniques.
Oh, it's crisp.
That takes 60 seconds to write. It is measurable, it is medically necessary, and it proves exactly what you were doing in the room.
One of the sources used a brilliant analogy for this. They called it the Route 66 analogy.
Oh, I love this one.
A treatment plan is basically a map for a road trip to New York. It is perfectly fine if you start driving on Route 66, hit a massive clinical roadblock, and realize you have to take a detour. You are allowed to change your therapeutic approach, but you have to prove to the auditor that you started the journey with a map.
Exactly. The map proves intentionality. It proves you aren't just chatting aimlessly with a vulnerable person for $150 an hour.
But let me ask you this, looking at it from the clinician's perspective. I get it for the insurance companies. I get it to protect my RCC license. But how does writing this rigid, medically necessary document actually help the client sitting on my couch? Isn't it just a bureaucratic chore?
That brings up a really vital point. It is actually profoundly clinical. When you review a measurable treatment plan with a client every 3 months, you are offering them a mirror to their own progress.
Oh, because healing isn't linear.
Right. Healing is rarely linear, and clients frequently forget how bad they felt on day one. When you pull out that map and say, hey, 3 months ago, you were experiencing 4 panic attacks a week. This past month, you only had one. They experience a massive, tangible sense of accomplishment.
That's powerful.
It builds trust in the process. And if the route isn't working, if the panic attacks haven't decreased, it gives the client permission to ask for a detour. It democratizes the therapy.
It turns a legal liability shield into an active therapeutic tool. That is brilliant.
Yeah.
Okay, we have covered an immense amount of ground today. Let's recap this roadmap for our BC beginner who is ready to launch. Number one. Claim your identity as a business owner the moment you take a check. Do not teeter, do not overincorporate, and whatever you do, do not commingle your funds and invite the CRA to rip apart your life. Open the separate accounts.
Yes. Number two, avoid the booked but broke trap. Plug the invisible leaks of unpaid admin and unenforced cancellations. Do the reverse engineered math to ensure your fee is based on sustainable capacity, and run a monthly P&L so you know exactly where every dollar is going.
Number three, weave your own safety net. Automate 5 to 10% of your income into a rainy day fund and recognize that the Canadian EI Special Benefits Program exists for you, but you have to opt in and pay premiums for a full 12 months before you can use it. Anticipate the future.
And finally, number four, put on your armor. Protect your hard work with entity-specific liability insurance and bulletproof 10-minute treatment plans that rely on measurable, medically necessary goals.
It's a lot of mechanics, but it is all deeply achievable. If you tackle these steps, you aren't just renting a room, you are building a resilient, predictable livelihood.
And I want to leave you with one final paradigm shift to mull over as you start this journey. Think about that tension we discussed at the beginning, the guilt therapists feel about embracing the business side. If you follow these steps, if you treat your practice as a highly profitable, strictly organized entity, consider this. How much more present, how much more grounded, and how much more deeply empathetic can you be in that therapy room when you aren't silently terrified about your own financial survival?
A secure therapist is a better therapist. You have the tools to build something incredibly real, something that serves your BC community and your own life. Thank you for joining us on this deep dive. You've got this. Keep moving forward, and we will see you on the next one.